Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Rachel Yoder. Rachel, thank you so much. I'm so glad to finally have the chance to talk with you.
Thanks, Gloria.
You have listened to some of these, and so you know that we start at the beginning. And I don't know a whole lot about you, but I'm pretty sure you were born in Oregon. Am I right?
That's right. I was born in Oregon City, in the old Oregon City Hospital, and second of seven kids in the family.
Your family goes back a little ways here in this part of the world, doesn't it?
It does. One of my great-grandmothers moved here with her parents, probably in the late 1890s. I would get in a... It must have been, because my grandmother was born here in about 1895. And my mother's family came in the 30s, but my dad's family was here a long time.
You said you are the second of seven children.
Yes.
That's quite a few. Did you grow up then in Oregon City, or where did you actually grow up?
I grew up, I was looking at a map. As the crow flies, it's about 2 miles from Zion Mennonite Church. So out in the country between, about halfway between Portland and Salem.
And what were your parents, or what was your father doing to make a living?
I asked him once when I had to fill out the FAFSA for college. I said, shall I put down truck driver? Because that's what I thought of it. And he said, put down laborer. You know, that's how he thought of his job. It was pretty interesting. He worked with the guys he grew up with at Needy Brick and Tile, which is a tile factory just, you know, halfway between us and Zion Mennonite Church.
Did you do any farming as well, or did you live in the country? Did you live in town?
I lived in the country. It was on a small farm. It wasn't, and we had some cows. We always had a milk cow, and we raised chickens for eating. So we would get 5,000 chickens at a time and have them for, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks before they were big enough to be eaten.
And I'm guessing that maybe you had to help with those chickens from time to time?
I didn't ever have to help catch them, which was, you know, quite the ordeal in the middle of the night, catching these chickens and stuffing them into cages on a big truck. But I helped feed them sometimes, and between batches of chickens, we always had to clear out the litter in the chicken house and put in fresh sawdust for the little ones when they came. Good fertilizer for the garden.
And as the second of seven, I'm guessing that you maybe had some duties around the household when it came to younger siblings as well?
I did. My older sister and the next younger sister, we were 1 year apart, each of us. So we, you know, by the time there were younger siblings that we were old enough to take care of, we shared that duty. Yeah, I remember changing diapers and all of those things, hanging clothes out on the line. We would rotate washing dishes and, you know, all the regular chores. And sometimes I could get away with not helping wash the dishes if I played the piano for the folks who were singing in the kitchen.
What church did your family attend, or were you associated with in those growing up years?
I went to Meadowbrook. Well, it was Meadowbrook Mennonite Church in the beginning. It was started as a mission by Zion Mennonite. The building was out in the country about halfway between Molalla and Oregon City. So the town of people may have driven through Molino. It's not too far from there. And it was started as a Mennonite mission, and it was a Mennonite church for and Mennonite pastors for maybe 20 years? No, maybe not that long. And then at that point, the building was sold to the congregation for a dollar. Zion Mennonite built the church, and then they gave it to the congregation because I think there wasn't a whole lot of interest in being Mennonites among the people in the community. There were probably 20 families from Zion Mennonite and from Molalla Mennonite who came and started that church. And so those are the people I knew when I was really young. And then later it was more people from the community around the church.
So were you there, like, say, through high school graduation at that church?
Yes. Yeah. And when after, even after college, when I came home, you know, on breaks and things that I would, that's where I would go to church until, well, until I started going to Portland Mennonite in the 1980s, I guess it was.
Did you attend public school?
I did. I went to 91 school, which is a public school, but I think half the teachers were Mennonites. My grandfather was the principal of the school, although not one, by the time I'd started, he had retired, but he was principal of the school. And when it was a two-room school, or even I think even when it was a one-room school, he was the teacher. He came to Oregon from Shipshawana for that job, and they met my grandmother in Oregon.
And is that the school that's near Zion Mennonite Church?
It is, yeah. The school is, the location is Whiskey Hill. When they had these small schools, they were like a mile apart. There was Whiskey Hill, and then a mile down the road was 91, and a mile down from that was Needy. And if you go the other direction, you know, go north-south, you'd hit a couple of other schools, and those all combined, and they called it 91 because Whiskey Hill was not deemed proper, I guess.
Well, 91 is kind of an interesting name for a school, too. What's the story there?
Actually, I don't. I think it was, well, 91 was the corner. The school at the corner, you know, the next corner down was 91 school. And I'm not sure why. When my grandpa was, when he was the principal, they changed the name to Hawthorne, but it didn't stick. And the only reason I knew about that is because we always play at his desk when we were at his house. And I found some pencils in his desk drawer that had the name scratched off. And he said, oh, that said Hawthorne. That name was not appropriate for our school. So he kept the pencils, but he scratched the name off with his little razor blade, no doubt.
In true Mennonite fashion.
Yes.
Waste not, want not.
Right.
Did you go to that school the whole time, or what's the story with education up through high school?
Through eighth grade. And then went to high school in Canby. So all of the smaller schools in that area, we all went to high school in Canby.
But it was still a public school.
Yes, yes.
I know you as an artistic person, to put it mildly, and you've already mentioned that you played the piano. Tell me about when and where that became something that you were aware of or involved with.
I guess it was, I don't know, it just seems like it was always there, always looking at things, making things and finding ways to build stuff. And it could be, you know, growing up in the country and playing in the woods. And my sister and I would collect, there had been sheep on the property before my parents bought it. And so in the woods, there were these little tufts of wool on the branches. And we collected and make little dolls out of it. Or we were pretty old, I think, when we quit riding our stick horses through the woods. But, you know, it was a lot of pretend, a lot of play. And I think that's where it came from.
Were either of your parents artistic in that regard? Do you know?
Well, they weren't. I mean, they wouldn't have said that. My mom took a lot of classes. She would take tailoring classes. She was always learning to do something new. She loved to cook. And my dad was always building things. But I don't think they would have thought of themselves as artists.
You graduated from high school. What came next and how did you make that decision?
I went to Reed College and studied math. And I knew that I wanted to be a math teacher. So I was able to get, at that time, I could get my teaching license and get my bachelor's in math within 4 years. There wasn't an extra year. I think I graduated the last year that it was possible to do that. And I'm not sure why I went to Reed. There was something about it that I just knew that's where I wanted to go. I applied to Lewis and Clark, and I applied to Whitman College in Walla Walla. And was accepted at all of them, but Reed was the one that was my first. I think it was those brick buildings covered with ivy. There was just something about it that appealed to me. It was the hippie days too, you know.
It looked like a college.
It did, yeah.
I'm fascinated that you didn't mention that you were interested or didn't apply to any of the Mennonite schools.
Well, I think it's because the church I went to during my high school years, it wasn't a Mennonite church anymore. And several of my classmates went to Goshen or went to Heston, but I don't know. For some reason, that was never on my radar.
And what was it about math, or what is it about math?
I think it really started in seventh grade when we did new math, you know, the so-called new math that, sings about, Tom Larrick's song about new math. And my teacher, I think it was tough for him to switch his mind to think about set theory and all the other, you know, base 10 and base 2, base 5, base 8, whatever it is we were doing. And I loved that stuff. And so for me, it made a lot of sense and it was really interesting. And I think that's where it started.
So you went to Reed for all 4 years?
I did.
And ended up with what degree?
I got a Bachelor of Arts in Math. And then I also applied and got my Oregon teaching license.
And what came next?
Well, there were no jobs in Oregon or Washington, which is, you know, I didn't want to get too far away from home. And I'd always thought, I'll teach for a while in a normal school, a regular place, and sometime I would like to go overseas and teach, you know, MCC or Peace Corps, one of those programs. And sometime I'd like to go way up north and teach in Alaska. I'd heard about people going up to northern Canada and teaching in the villages up there, and I thought that just sounded fascinating to me. But I couldn't find that regular job, so I just skipped that part and applied to Peace Corps and MCC at the same time. Peace Corps accepted me first for a term in Botswana, and MCC, like a couple of weeks later, I got the letter from MCC. Everything was letter in those days. I got the letter from MCC, and they offered me a position in Lesotho. So, you know, I would have ended up in Southern Africa either way. I'm not sure why Peace Corps, maybe Peace Corps got the nod because it's a 2-year commitment instead of 3 years. I'm not sure about that. But I remember when the letter came, my dad and I looked at it and said, Botswana, is that one of those countries that's completely surrounded by South Africa? So we got out the atlas and we looked at it and said, oh yeah, I'm going.
And what year was that?
That was in 76. Well, yeah, I left in January of 76. So I missed the whole bicentennial thing, which is a bummer. Except that on the 4th of July, because my school was in a town that was not too far from the capital in Botswana, the embassy in Botswana hosted a big party. And so a bunch of us went up and played softball and had barbecue. And then in the evening, the local theater was showing American Graffiti. So we all went and watched American Graffiti. I remember it. That's the only part of the bicentennial that I did not miss. It was really fun.
And you're talking about the U.S. bicentennial.
Yes, yes. It was Botswana's 10th year anniversary. So 10 years as an independent country, and big hoopla for that too. It was pretty amazing. All of the presidents not South Africa, but the other surrounding countries came and spoke in our town, and we went down with the school kids and listened to them.
So what was your actual assignment in Botswana?
I was a secondary school math teacher. And I think in the Peace Corps now, they try to keep volunteers a little more busy, but we had so much free time. So we taught the regular school terms for 10 or 11 weeks at a time. And then we would get at least four weeks off, maybe 6 weeks off. And so everybody would travel. We'd just hit the road, go to South Africa or go to, it was still Rhodesia at that time, or go, you know, just get out, take advantage of where you were, get out and see the sights.
What was your living situation while you were actually in Botswana?
I lived in a brand new house that was my own house. I mean, it was so new that when I started teaching, the house wasn't finished yet. And so they put me up in a hotel for the first month, and I ate all my meals in the hotel dining room, which was one of those places where people would, you know, drive from other towns to eat there. But that's where I ate all of my meals. And and then I moved into my own house. It was a small two-bedroom house, cinder block construction. The house was interesting because the living room and dining room were in one building, an L-shaped building, and the bedrooms were a separate building, but there was this covered walkway between them and a courtyard that hemmed it all in. And I had that house to myself for a year. And then the second year, one of the students who was from out of town stayed at my place and lived in the other, so he had the other bedroom.
Did you have electricity and running water in that house?
I did. Yeah, it was a good deal.
And was this in the capital city?
No, this was about maybe 45 miles south of the capital city, just a couple of miles from the South Africa border in Lobatse.
What was sort of the status, maybe the financial status of your actual students?
They were, you know, there was a mix, but most of them were pretty poor. They, you know, it would be all they could do to afford the school uniform and the school fees for books and supplies. The first year, I think at the end of the school year, those who were graduating were really upset because the bursar, who was in charge of giving them refunds for things that had not been spent of their school fees, left, and they were practically rioting, you know, throwing chairs off the veranda and things like that. And I was so mad at them. I just marched right into the middle of it and said, "Knock it off. What are you doing? Go home." And because I'd had a lot of them in class, they realized I could identify them maybe. So they quit. I'm sort of surprised now that I did that. But I thought, you know, you don't have a lot of money and the school doesn't have a lot of money. Don't destroy things.
And you were teaching in English because that was the colonial language, is that right?
It was one of the official languages. So English and Setswana were the official languages. And the kids learned English in primary school.
So you were there for 2 years, and I'm sure there are just 1,000 stories that we're not going to have time for right now. But at the end of that 2 years, did you have an option to re-up for more time, or what was the story at that point for you?
There was an option to re-up, and I was going to do it, and then there was a shake-up in the Peace Corps administration, and I decided, plus some of the other people that I worked with were planning this cross-country adventure, this trans-Africa adventure, and so I decided to go with them. We bought a used Land Rover, and we hit the road. We drove all the way to London. It took us 5 months.
How many of you were there in this little group?
There were five of us, so four Peace Corps volunteers and one Canadian CUSO volunteer. And the Canadian left in Zaire. Well, it's not Zaire, whatever it's called now.
Democratic Republic of Congo now.
He left then, but we knew that ahead of time that he was going to go partway with us. And the other four of us went on.
Who came up with this idea? And let me just say, this is like long before the internet, so you couldn't just Google things and figure out the route. Tell me how this came about.
You know, I'm not sure where the idea came from. I mean, it was pretty common to do. There were two different groups of people I knew at that time who were planning to do this. And we read books that came, I think they came from the library, or maybe, I don't know if someone should, other people who had done this wrote memoirs, and then we read their books, we made plans. We had the Michelin maps to figure out where we were going to go. And then once we were on the road, every time we passed another vehicle that clearly was doing what we were doing, with, you know, the jerry cans piled on the roof and whatever else that let you know what was happening, we'd stop and talk for a while. We'd exchange stories. They were coming from the north heading south, and so, you know, we could exchange where to stay when you get to certain towns, because we camped all the way. Where to buy gas? If you're in some places, that would be an issue.
This is in 1978.
70, yeah, it was 78 because, yeah, we left in December of 77.
So is it safe to say that as you headed out, you didn't have a specific route in mind, or you did? And
we had a specific route, and I think we stuck to it pretty much. And it was partly due, I mean, there was really only one way to go. Because technically in East Africa, the borders were closed. You couldn't go from Tanzania to Kenya. Idi Amin was still in power in Uganda, so you couldn't do that. So that meant we went up to Tanzania. We actually went into Kenya and came back to Tanzania. I don't remember how we talked them into letting us do that. But and then we went across, you know, so straight across through Rwanda, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Empire, Cameroon, and then headed north across the Sahara in Nigeria.
And you said you ended up in London. Now, Is it possible to drive there, or do you need a boat at some point?
A couple of boats, yeah. So we went through Algeria and then headed west into Morocco. And when we were done in Morocco, we took the ferry across at Gibraltar. And then drove through Spain and France and then took the ferry across at, I don't know where we were.
And then after you got to London, you flew home from there, or did you take a boat home from there?
No, we were ready to get, we were all teachers and we were thinking, it's May, we got to get home, we got to find jobs. And so I flew home from there. I still remember the flight. I remember, you know, I'd been on the road for 5 months. The dirt, yeah, I could rub my hands and the dirt would come off. It was just embedded in everything. And I remember asking the flight attendant when she asked if I wanted to watch the movie. I said, what is it? Oh, it's Saturday Night Fever. Oh, what's it about? And she explained it to me. I said, oh, no, I don't think so. I'm just going to sleep.
And you were headed ultimately back to Oregon at that point?
Yes, yeah, back to Portland. So I flew from London to Portland. I might have gone to Seattle first, but it was a quick trip home after all those months on the road.
I wish we just had hours and hours to hear your stories, but have you written this down?
I have my journals that I kept, and I've written some of it down. And one of the woman that who was part of the traveling group has been writing her stories down. So it'll be fun to see how she's remembered all of that.
You are still in touch with some, at least one, maybe several of these people that you made this trip with?
Well, this year at Christmas, because I sent out that Christmas letter, we all were together on the same email thread for, you know, a couple of passes. And it was so much fun just getting caught up with everybody.
So what did you eventually find to do when you got home?
Well, there still weren't any jobs.
What was going on?
This was like early, someplace I read when my niece graduated from college and she was looking for a job. I heard that the job market at that point was the worst it had been since it was in 78 when I got home and was looking for a job. There were not any teaching jobs. And I ended up, a job was posted in the Oregonian for teachers in Alaska. And so I interviewed here in Oregon and went to Alaska for 3 years.
So you actually made it to Alaska too?
I did. Plan B and C, good. Check them off.
Well, we don't have much time left, so we have to somehow get you back to Portland and Portland Mennonite Church. Can you give me the abridged version of how that happened?
So I was just thinking about this morning. A quick abridged version is that I got in touch with the MCCers in Botswana when I was there and went to their monthly fellowship gatherings and went to their annual retreats. And so that's when I really hooked up with Mennonites and realized what kind of affinity I had for their theology, not just the music. And so then after that, when I was near a Mennonite church, that's where I attended. So once I ended up in Portland, I ended up at Portland Mennonite.
Because you eventually got a teaching job in Portland?
No, I quit teaching after Alaska. 5 years was enough. I went to school in Michigan, and my sister was going to Goshen at the time, and she helped me. We moved to the Midwest at the same time, and she said, well, let's just look in the phone book and see where the Mennonite church is, once I had found my apartment. And it was like 2 blocks from the apartment where I was renting. So, of course, I went there, and it was a good experience. And that, you know, that really cemented what I had seen among the MCCers in Botswana.
So where was this exactly?
It was in Grand Rapids, and it was North Park Mennonite Church.
So what year did you actually end up at Portland Mennonite Church?
I moved back to Oregon in 83, and I think it was 84. So I lived in Canby for a year and then moved to Portland when I was going to Portland State.
Well, there are obviously many, many more pieces to this story. I know you, well, I know you from Portland Mennonite, obviously, but I know you as a piano player, one of our piano players. But I also know you as a quilter, and that you have made some amazing wall hangings. I don't know what you call them. I call them wall hangings. One that springs to mind is the Lord's Prayer. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's hanging, or had been, I think it might still be, somewhere at Portland Mennonite.
I think Rod said it was in his office.
And another one that I know that you made was one called like a calendar for a quote-unquote ordinary time. Uh-huh. And usually sometime during the year that ends up on the front of our pulpit.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's been happening for at least a couple of years now. So I will just throw that out there for the congregation, because a lot of people won't probably know that you're the one who has done all this beautiful work. And at some point, you then moved out of Portland to the beautiful Oregon coast. What's the story there?
After I quit teaching, I got a degree in mechanical engineering and worked in energy conservation programs for 10 years. And then when that, I don't know, somehow I wasn't interested in being a program manager anymore. And I quit and went to art school. And then after art school, I was back in that looking for a job thing. And, you know, sort of thrashing around, I ended up teaching in San Jose for just one semester, but I got the teaching bug again from that. And so after that semester, I came back to Portland and went to Portland State again and got my teaching license reinstated, and have taught here in Lincoln City for 20 years. Well, I did. Now I'm retired. Yay! Especially in time of COVID.
So you have just the most amazing stories, and I could just talk to you or listen to you forever and ever, but as we're ending up here, is there something that you would like to say about yourself, about Portland Mennonite, about the pandemic? Give us some encouraging final words here.
Let's see. Well, it's interesting to me that I attend a church here in Lincoln City that's similar in theology to Portland Mennonite, with a little more, I can't believe they actually take that literally. And Portland Mennonite doesn't do that, which I appreciate. But there's something about the congregation at Portland Mennonite. I think the fact that there are such a variety of people there, such a wide age range, you can tell that people want to be there, and they bring their friends, and their friends want to be there. And it's a welcoming place to be. And for me, I wish I was there more often, but, you know, it's the drive. And I had thought when I moved to Lincoln City that I would, you know, move back to Portland when I retired. But now I'm thinking I'll stay here as long as I'm mobile.
Because who doesn't want to live on the Oregon coast?
That's right.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time to share just the few of your amazing stories and give us just a glimpse into your amazing life.
Well, you're welcome, Gloria. I appreciate the chance to rattle on.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions or you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.